So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F-35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has joined Governor Tony Evers in calling for passage of what's called a red flag law. It's also called the Extreme Risk Protection Order. That's in the bill introduced by Representative Melissa Sargent. But how would that red flag law work in Wisconsin? So I want to thank Attorney General Josh Call for taking the time to talk to us about this. Thank you, sir, very much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
What difference would a red flag law, before we get into how it works, what difference do you think it would make, sir?
Well, you know, we've all seen these horrendous tragedies that have happened around the country, including here in Wisconsin, in Oak Creek. We had a shooting last year in Middleton where four people were injured. Mm-hmm. And this is legislation that would allow us to take a step towards working to prevent that type of incident, working to prevent other acts of gun violence, and that includes suicides, by creating a process that allows a law enforcement official or a family member or a household member, when they see signs that somebody may be a danger to themselves or others, to go to a judge and to petition for an order that would allow that person to be temporarily disarmed. The idea is to give law enforcement and family members and household members a tool that can help potentially avert a tragedy.
Would it be aimed primarily at preventing mass shootings or suicides? Because I know your office just today noted that it's National Suicide Prevention Month. So dual goals, which would be the chief goal?
It would be both. It would be anytime somebody is in a crisis where they're presenting a threat to themselves or to somebody else, because I think it could help save lives in either situation. You know, we saw before some of these tragedies, in the case of Parkland, for example, or Dayton, the person who committed that tragedy exhibited warning signs. And if law enforcement had a tool that allowed them to temporarily disarm that person, hopefully that could make a difference. But it's also true that this could make a difference in the case of suicides. In Connecticut, which has had a red flag law in place for about 20 years, data has shown that law has had an impact in reducing suicides. And so hopefully this would give family members who see a family member in trouble a tool that they can use to help save lives.
And quoting from your press release today, 163 law officers have already taken their lives this year. So it's a suicide. So is this a growing problem with our first-line law officers?
Suicide is an issue that impacts people in across the country in all sorts of different professions. And law enforcement officers see things on a day-in and day-out basis that are really challenging to witness. You know, they encounter really difficult circumstances, and working to improve officer wellness is something that's important to me and to the entire Department of Justice. It's one of the many reasons that we need to make sure that we're working to destigmatize mental health issues and to encourage people to get help if they can benefit from it.
The Assembly Task Force on Suicide Prevention just presented recommendations last week. It didn't do anything with guns, but it did provide, it recommended grants for groups that train staff at firearm retailers, groups and local governments, potentially funding trigger locks and firearm locks, high school peer-to-peer suicide prevention programs. Have you had a chance to look through the recommendations? Do you think they go far enough, sir?
I think a lot of the recommendations that were made are good ones and worth looking at. But it's also a missed opportunity, I think, to do a lot more to help save lives. And I do think one of the areas that they missed that opportunity on is not including a red flag law. As you mentioned, there are some funds in there to provide training to people who are selling firearms to identify signs of suicide. And frankly, I think a red flag law makes a lot more sense. I think these decisions about whether or not somebody presents a danger shouldn't be made by somebody who's selling firearms, but rather should be made by a judge based on testimony in a formal proceeding. To me, that's a more effective way to administer this, and it's a fair way to people who are looking to purchase guns so that they're not being subject to what's decided by the person who happens to be working at the store where they're going, but instead they have a judge making that decision.
At that press conference, you and the governor, both endorsed red flag and universal background checks. Which of those two would be most effective, sir?
It's hard to compare. I mean, I view them as really complementary. What a universal background check law would do is ensure that anybody who is selling a gun to another person has to have a check conducted, so they know if they're the sale is one that's prohibited. So that type of law would prevent people who are prohibited from possessing firearms because, for example, they've committed a felony from getting a gun in the first place. A red flag law operates when somebody already has a gun. Yes. And in that case, if they've done something that indicates that they're a threat to themselves or others, in that case, it would provide a process to allow for intervention. So to me, they're sort of flip sides of the same coin. They both help us try to avert a tragedy.
And they both need to be enacted in Wisconsin as a matter of public safety?
I think both of them would promote public safety in Wisconsin, that's right.
Would our red flag law be modeled after Connecticut, Indiana, which state?
So the draft that's been introduced is based largely on existing laws in Wisconsin that provide for example, domestic violence restraining orders. Those laws have a similar process where there's a temporary order that can be issued, followed by a longer temporary order. And significantly, those laws provide that people are required to surrender firearms if they're subject to one of those injunctions. So this is a similar process to something that already exists in Wisconsin. You know, we also looked at the bill that had previously been introduced by Representative Sargent. But those both influenced what the bill ended up looking like.
Okay, let's focus on how our bill, the Extreme Risk Protection Order law, would work. Who could file a petition?
So there would be three groups of people, like law enforcement members,
right.
A household member, and a family member. So it would be a limited category of people who could file the petition, and then they would need to make a showing to a judge for a temporary order to be issued.
What would they have to say to really file a petition that qualified for a formal hearing?
So the process would proceed in two parts. The first step, which would be before a judge or a circuit court commissioner, would allow for the issuance of an order that lasts for 14 days. And the idea there is to get an order if somebody is in a crisis situation so you can take an immediate step to avert a tragedy. And there they would need to show that there's reasonable cause to believe that the person is substantially likely to injure another person or themselves if they have possession of a firearm. Then there would be, there's the potential for a second longer order, which could be for up to a year. And in that case, they need to show by clear and convincing evidence that it's substantially likely that the person would cause harm to themselves or another person if they had access to a firearm. So there's a clear standard in place. There would be review by a judge, and also the person who was required to surrender their firearm would have an opportunity to petition to have their right to have possession of a firearm restored if an injunction was issued. So it's a process that is a pretty rigorous one where there has to be an order issued by a judge. And it's one that's been upheld in other states. The red flag laws have been upheld in both Connecticut and in Indiana.
The burden of proof in those would be on the person named in the petition?
No, the burden would be on the petitioner to establish that the person, the respondent, is substantially likely to cause harm to another. If an order were issued and the person whose rights were at stake wanted to petition to have that reviewed, at that point the burden would be on that person to seek to have that order reversed. But the burden for the initial showing would be on the petitioners.
How would this work ideally? In an ideal situation, would a family member who feels threatened by someone who they consider dangerous go to a law officer? In other words, would it be better from a legal standpoint for a law officer or a family member? Which one would be more seriously considered by a judge potentially?
I think that what the judge would want to see is what the facts are. And so if it's somebody who has firsthand knowledge, like a family member, that their family member is suicidal or has made threats to commit some sort of tragedy, At that point, having the family member who can speak directly to it, I think, is valuable evidence. But I also think it's valuable having a law enforcement officer who is, you know, an expert in public safety, go and speak to how a situation that's presented might be different from a more run-of-the-mill scenario. So both options are ones that are I think, good options and ones that would be upheld because of the rigor that would go into the decision made by the judge.
So would there be two phases of this process? In other words, a judge or a court commissioner would consider a 14-day order and then also in a second hearing, a potential order of a year, General?
That's right.
Okay. And would the person named in the petition, who may be a danger to himself or others, would he or she have a right to an attorney?
I think that the way that process would work hasn't been designated, but I think absolutely in practice, any judge would allow them to have an attorney at that hearing.
If they couldn't afford one, would it fall to a public defender's, sir?
This would be a civil proceeding, so it wouldn't be like a criminal proceeding where there was a public defender appointed. But I think including a process that makes sure that people are represented in the hearings is an appropriate thing for the legislature to take a look at as it considers this legislation.
And how long do you think some of these hearings would last? Potentially beyond a day, which involves scheduling a judge or a court commissioner's calendar?
I don't think they would likely last that long. These would be focused on the specific conduct that led to somebody being viewed by the family member or the law enforcement officer as a threat to the safety of others. And, you know, the person would then have the opportunity to argue that either didn't happen or it's not a sufficient basis for a red flag law, but or for an order being issued. But I think those would be fairly narrow and specific hearings.
So the person named in the ERPO petition would have a right to examine witnesses?
So that would be decided by the judge who is holding the hearing, but I would imagine that that's what the judge would find, that the person does have that right, yes.
Okay. Would there be then a second hearing regarding the one-year period?
That's right. There would be the initial hearing, and that one could be ex parte. That's why it's a limited in duration order. The second hearing would be the hearing for the order that would last for up to a year, potentially.
Is there a requirement that a judge or a court commissioner hear this petition for a 14-day order within 24, 48 hours?
There's no specific requirement as to when they need to hear it. It would be we'd be relying on the judgment of that judge or court commissioner. If it's a situation where there's an emergency that's presented, I fully expect that the judge would act quickly. It's a similar setup, as I mentioned, to some other sort of emergency orders that can be issued, like a temporary restraining order that's meant to prevent against domestic violence. There's no specific time in which judges need to act, but I think that if they see that a situation is urgent, they'll act quickly.
What about a family member who finds the courage to find an ERPO petition, but then is worried about the potential retribution by the person who they filed against, whether it's a spouse or someone they're living with? Isn't that a concern?
That's a concern in all sorts of different types of criminal proceedings. But because this is a situation that involves the risk of harm to the respondent or to others, my hope and I think what would happen is that family members in certain circumstances would say that, you know, it's so important that we work to prevent this potential act of harm that I need to come forward. And I think that's what we would see.
Based on numbers in Connecticut and Indiana, how many ERPOs would you see being filed in Wisconsin in a given year? 3,300? What?
It's really difficult to say in the abstract. I mean, it would depend on, first of all, how well publicized this process is. And, I think in certain circumstances, making sure that law enforcement is providing that option to petitioners and working closely with them. But it's meant to be limited in nature to circumstances where somebody can be shown to present a danger to others or to themselves. So the overall number is likely to be fairly limited, but it would depend on what circumstances ultimately arise and what comes before a court.
Do you see it being used primarily in our urban counties, Milwaukee, Brown, Waukesha, Dane?
No, I think this would be used across the state of Wisconsin. I mean, as we've seen with these horrible mass shootings, they can happen in all sorts of different types of communities. And communities across the state have been impacted by suicide as well. And this is a tool that I think would help people in all sorts of different types of communities around Wisconsin.
So a judge would have the option then of saying that there is a finding that this person is dangerous to himself and others. Therefore, he or she could not possess a weapon for 14 days temporarily. And then if at a second hearing, potentially up to a year, then does the person have to surrender weapons, or would law enforcement go to their home?
So an order would be issued requiring that person to surrender the weapons. If the person didn't comply with that order at that point, law enforcement, you know, may be required to execute the order and to recover the weapons. But the person would be ordered to surrender it. So, you know, in most cases, hopefully the person in that circumstance is going to comply with the court order.
How would a judge know whether an individual named in an ERPO petition has 3 or 30 weapons?
So the information would hopefully be included in the petition to the extent that the petitioner knows how many weapons a person has access to. But the person would also be required to surrender all firearms in their possession, and they would need to, you know, verify that they're doing that. And if they don't surrender all their firearms, they would be subject to a penalty for failing to do that.
Do you have a fear that someone named in an ERPO petition who's ordered not to possess or own weapons for, let's say, a year, gets so angry at this process that they steal or borrow a gun and commit some type of heinous crime?
I think it is always possible that somebody in a court proceeding may be unhappy with the way that the proceeding is going. But by definition here, we're talking about people who have been determined to be a danger to themselves or others. And, you know, at that point, I don't think the court process is going to be what's leading to violence or some sort of criminal activity. And on the contrary, I think that this process first would help by disarming the person, but also could help by just having that intervention in the court process, having law enforcement or a family member intervene and hopefully get the person to take a step back. And, you know, if it's somebody who is suicidal, for example, hopefully this intervention would make the difference and cause them to not to act in a way that, you know, we certainly don't want them to.
As somebody who studied mass shootings, what do you see as the common characteristics by the shooters generally?
Well, there's no one single characteristic, but one thing to look for is that, you know, if people are, you know, particularly interested in mass shootings, or they're stockpiling some very large amount of weapons, those are characteristics we sometimes see. But what's critical to know is that there are all sorts of different scenarios that are presented, and the people who will see up close when somebody might be presenting that kind of danger are people like family members or household members or law enforcement officers who have seen a lot of different scenarios and can make an appropriate judgment about when somebody's really a danger to public safety, and that's whose hands we're trying to put these decisions in.
Would the testimony include both personal anecdotes about threats made and their social media activity?
It would be up to the judge to decide what type of testimony is appropriate, but ultimately you'd want to have testimony that speaks to whether the person is presenting a danger to themselves or others. And so if they made threats on social media, or if they had a history of threatening violence, that's certainly something that would be relevant. But ultimately, a judge or a circuit court commissioner would be making that determination.
This is one additional process that police, sheriff's deputies, DAs, and judges would have to deal with as part of our criminal justice system. Have they indicated support for a proposed ERPO law?
Well, I believe that the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association has registered in favor of this. The police chief from Middleton, where that tragedy happened last year, has spoken out in favor of a red flag law. And as we mentioned before, I think the number of orders that would be issued would not be a huge number, so I think it would be limited in terms of the impact on the court system. And the other thing that's important to mention here is the purpose of these laws is to try to allow for law enforcement to intervene and prevent a tragedy from happening. And if we can prevent those tragedies from happening, that certainly makes it worth the minimal extra time and effort in the court proceedings we'd see.
Representative Sargent's press release made this interesting point. If you filed a false ERPO petition, that would be a felony?
That's right.
But that's a whole other separate crime, correct?
It would be basically the same crime as falsely swearing under oath, because to file the petition, that's what you need to do. So there are serious consequences if somebody were to try to abuse this process, and that's why I don't think it would be abused.
Do you think there'd be widespread anger at someone who broke up with someone so they filed an ERPO petition?
Well, they would be facing a felony punishment if they did that, so I don't think that's likely to happen.
Okay, after a judge issues a 14-day order, then is it up to the person named in the ERPO petition to seek this, to try to have it overturned? What's the timetable after a 14 or a one-year order is issued, sir?
When the 14-day is ordered, that order only lasts, by definition, for 14 days.
Certainly.
And the hearing would need to be scheduled within that time period. That would just happen automatically as a result of the issuance of the order. And at that hearing that follows that, which would relate to the order that would last for up to a year, the person who's the respondent would be in this. They would be starting from scratch, essentially. The judge would need to determine by clear and convincing evidence that person was substantially likely to harm another person or themselves if they had access to a firearm. So again, the burden would be on the petitioner, not on the respondent there.
Okay, just to clarify, if a 14-day order was issued, would that automatically trigger a second hearing on whether a one-year order should be issued?
It would trigger a hearing as to an order of up to 1 year is issued. The judge could issue it for a shorter period of time if he or she chose to.
And could the person named in the ERPO petition seek to have that order vacated within that 1 year period?
That's right. So if the order of up to 1 year is issued, the person who the order is issued against has an opportunity during the duration of that order to ask for that to be reconsidered.
Okay. You saw the response from both Speaker Voss and Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald after you and the governor called for this. And they said, and I'm paraphrasing, this would be taking away Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. I hope that's an accurate paraphrase. Your response?
That's wrong. First of all, red flag laws have been challenged, as I mentioned before, in two other states. They were both upheld. And this is a process that focuses just on people who've been shown to present a danger to themselves or others. There are other areas of the law where people in that category are prohibited from possessing a firearm. For example, somebody convicted of a felony is not permitted to possess a firearm in Wisconsin. And as I mentioned, this process is modeled off of processes that already exist in Wisconsin. If a domestic violence restraining injunction is issued against someone, they're not permitted to possess a firearm. This is a similar process, and this process is constitutional, just like that process is.
How do you and the governor get it passed when the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader say it's a non-starter, sir?
The public overwhelmingly supports red flag laws. The latest Marquette poll showed 81% support for legislation of this sort. So we're going to continue advocating for it and encouraging the legislature to take this legislation up. There was recently a letter drafted by the executive director for the League of Municipalities in Wisconsin. It was signed by over 180 local leaders calling for action to address gun violence. The public is calling for action to address this issue. We have proposals on the table that will make a difference if we're able to move forward with them. So we're calling on the legislature to take these proposals up, and at the very least, to hold a hearing so that these issues can be debated for the public and the best ideas can be ones that are ultimately enacted.
At that press conference, the governor was asked about a gun buyback proposal. Is that something you see any merit in, General?
I don't think there's going to be any legislation introduced in this session that would do anything of that kind. I think it's important that we focus on these two measures that have been introduced, universal background checks and a red flag law. Those are laws that make a difference. They're laws that have very broad public support. Both of them are supported by about 4 out of 5 Wisconsinites, and I think that our focus should be on those pieces of legislation and getting something done.
Just a couple more questions. Schools just started. In the wake of the more than $100 million passed to make our schools safer, how significantly safer are our schools against these tragic mass shooting incidents now?
There's no question that funding has helped make our schools safer, because schools have been able to improve the physical security of their buildings. That upgrade process is ongoing. The vast majority of the money has been awarded, but the upgrade process is continuing. But we've got to look at this issue holistically, because kids in Wisconsin should be as safe going to school as they possibly can be. And, you know, we have seen these horrific tragedies at some schools. We have seen that millions of kids go through lockdowns. Schools across the state and country conduct lockdown drills now, and we've got to have a holistic response to that. And so improving physical security at schools is part of that, but I also think we need to invest in social and emotional learning at schools and social workers and mental health professionals, and we've got to consider common sense gun safety measures that are going to make our schools
safer. Isn't it interesting that my grandchildren in the Waukesha School District and your grandchildren now have these emergency simulations and responses to potential mass shootings? What does that say?
Well, I don't have grandchildren yet, Steve, but my kids, you know, my older son just started kindergarten, and the school he goes to does these drills. The daycare that he went to and his brother still goes to, they conduct lockdown drills. And we don't know what the impacts of that are going to be on kids, but there's no question that it is scary for kids, and it is scary for parents and grandparents. Kids should feel safe going to our schools. And if we can take common sense actions that don't infringe on anybody's Second Amendment rights, that have broad support from the public, I think we need to take those actions.
One final question on this subject. No doubt in your mind a red flag law would save lives in Wisconsin in general?
I believe it would, yes. If you look at what happened in Connecticut, suicides have been reduced from having that law in place. And there are clearly circumstances where someone presents a danger to others who makes one of these threats, for example. Having law enforcement have a tool to intervene absolutely could save lives.
Okay, one final question, different subject. The bankruptcy by Purdue Pharma. The state of Wisconsin has filed suit. Many local governments have filed suit. What does the bankruptcy do to any potential recoveries from Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family, General?
So we'll see how the bankruptcy process plays out. That remains to be seen. But when a bankruptcy happens, that consolidates a lot of claims into a single action. But, you know, as the state of Wisconsin has filed suit against two Purdue entities, many counties in Wisconsin have filed suit. And now it's going to be through the bankruptcy forum, potentially, where a lot of the recovery from Purdue or from its estate may happen. You know, whether the Sackler family members become part of that bankruptcy proceeding or not remains to be seen, but we're going to continue aggressively pursuing our claims, because this epidemic has been devastating for families around the state, and we need to get the resources we can to help fund treatment efforts, education efforts, and enforcement efforts in communities in Wisconsin.
Does bankruptcy reduce the odds that state of Wisconsin and local governments will eventually recover some damages?
I think it's going to change the way the process plays out. I mean, the fact that Purdue has announced that it's bankrupt means that there's a limited pool of funds that are going to be available to be distributed, and that's really unfortunate, because it means that there's going to be less that the state of Wisconsin and counties can recover from Purdue. But while Purdue has announced it's gone bankrupt, members of the Sackler family have made billions and billions of dollars from Purdue, and that money has been removed from the company. That's the reason that I think that the settlement that was on the table was not a good enough deal for Wisconsinites. We need to do more to hold the Sacklers accountable than that deal would do, and that's what we intend to continue pursuing.
So we'll see how that legal process plays out.
That's right. There are going to be extensive legal proceedings going forward.
Attorney General Josh Call.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civic broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol. Wisconsin Eye would not exist without generous donors like you. Please visit wisi.org to make a donation today.